This is The Right Opinion Show with Ed Furtick. Sitting in for Ed today, Columbia County Clerk Holly Tanner and her guest, Congressman Chris Gibson. Things were gone, work for all my life, and I had to start again, just my children and my wife. Thank my lucky stars to be living here today, 'cause the flag still stands for freedom and they can't take that away. And I'm proud to be an American, where at least I know I'm free. And I won't forget the men who died, who gave that right to me. And I gladly stand up next to you and defend her still today, 'cause there ain't no doubt I love this land. God bless the USA. From the lakes of Minnesota to the hills of Tennessee, across the plains of Texas, from sea to shining sea, Detroit down to Houston, and New York to LA, where there's pride in every American heart, and it's time we stand and say that I'm proud to be an American, where at least I know I'm free, and I won't forget the men who died.
And good morning, everyone. This is Holly Tanner. You're listening to The Right Opinion on WGXC. As Phil mentioned, I'm not your normal host of this show. Ed Furtick is out, but I'm thrilled to be sitting in, especially today. I have a very special guest that I couldn't be more excited about, Congressman Chris Gibson. Thank you for coming in and spending a little time with us, Congressman.
Hey, great to be with you, and great to see you and Phil. And we miss Ed, but we appreciate we have a moment to reflect on that as we listen to that great song that he's given to us.
That's Ed's opening song, yes, and we will leave it as such while I fill in here, because we don't want to invoke the wrath of Ed. So hi, Ed, I know you're listening and we miss you. So Congressman Gibson, it's certainly been my pleasure. We've had the opportunity to campaign together and work together, and you know, you're a local man, Columbia County, born and raised and living in Kinderhook now with your lovely wife Mary Jo and your children. And we're going to jump right in here, folks. So 24 years in the armed services, in the serving the country. And let me be, I know I'm not the first to say this, but I'm going to say it again anyway. You know, thank you for your service to our country. You know, it's amazing. And then you retire, rank of colonel, and you come home. And instead of, you know, you could have done any number of things, you choose to continue your life in public service. And, you know, it's really a wonderful thing for you to do. So with your military background, we're going to jump right into some very serious issues going on in the world today. And everyone's seen the just horrendous video on the news about the children and the women, the innocent victims who've been gassed by their own country. It just boggles my mind, and it's horrific. I can't even watch, but yet you can't not watch. So let's jump right into Syria, yeah, and give us your thoughts, Congressman.
Well, indeed. Very serious situation, a humanitarian crisis. Our thoughts and prayers go out to the victims, to the families. But I would also tell you that actually 29 years in uniform, 5 years in the Army National Guard, 24 years, as you point out, in the regular Army, starting all that as a private, rising to colonel, brigade command in the 82nd Airborne Division, multiple combat tours. You know, it's my military judgment that if we were to intervene militarily, we wouldn't resolve this matter, as saddening as it is. In my view, we'd actually make it worse. We would exacerbate the situation. You know, some of the things talked about is potentially cruise missile strikes into Syria. And, you know, this is not going to end that civil war. And in fact, very tragically, we'll end up killing people. We may even kill innocent people. And here it is. We're upset and certainly distraught over the loss of civilian life, and then we could exacerbate that. And it's not going to change the military equation, and there's so much at stake here. You know, this is you've got not only the warring factions in Syria, Russia, there's Hezbollah, Iran, Israel, the potential for a wider conflict. We have to be very careful, I think, in the way we address this. I do support the diplomatic efforts that are underway. There have been efforts to bring the warring factions to Geneva for peace talks. I think that's exactly the right thing that we should be doing. I've been urging the administration to fully think this through. Do not intervene militarily in Syria. We will end up Americanizing that civil war, and that is not our role. You know, this country, we're a republic. There is a place for us to – we certainly lead. We lead with our ideas. These are our strengths, as instantiated in our founding documents that provide for freedom and for a flourishing form of life. We know we're not perfect, and we're always striving to get better. But other countries want to be like us because of the freedom that comes with these institutions that we have cherished over time. And when we use that moral strength with our diplomacy and our economic leverage, we can make a difference. But when we intervene militarily, and oftentimes we make matters worse, and we actually make it tougher for us too, because, look, we're in a sequester. We need to find a replacement for that sequester, a pro-growth, fiscally responsible replacement for that sequester, important investments we need to make for our country. The last thing we should be doing is exacerbating a civil war, Americanizing it, and spending taxpayer dollars in a situation that's going to make matters worse. So, you know, look, it's a tough situation. I certainly understand the impulse to act, but my point is we need to think it through. Just for example, Holly, you know, just think through this latest discussion, you know, the idea of hurling cruise missiles. First of all, we've already signaled that, which means that the Syrian forces can already reposition, knowing that that potential could occur. And, you know, militarily, as I said, it will not change the equation substantially on the ground. It's likely to embolden forces because at that point we'll have been committed militarily. I suspect that you'll see a Syrian reaction of some kind. Iran has already said that that should America get involved in this, that they could potentially expand this, including attack on Israel. And you've got Russia involved in this. It's not clear at all to me where this goes if we initiate military action. Let me also say this, the rebels. The situation on the ground with the rebels is very unclear. And I say that as somebody who's served in Iraq multiple times, and that's the real challenge, is the uncertainty, that situational awareness, not having it impedes understanding and effective action. And we've got a situation where some of these rebels actually shot at my paratroopers. And right. I'm concerned that we're going to end up emboldening forces that are anathema to our country. So for a variety of reasons, I'm urging us not to get involved militarily, including not arming rebels, and then to continue the path of urging a peaceful resolution to the matter, including our diplomatic activities.
Very good. Yeah, and I imagine it's got to be very difficult to understand and address all of the issues. And as you mentioned, there's different forces involved, different countries, different implications, and the actions that, you know, it's that ripple effect. You throw the pebble in the pond, and then the ripple effect goes out from there. So,
and, you know, the diplomacy and economic leverage that we can bring to bear does make a difference. It can change behavior. No country can survive isolated. And mm-hmm. The regime understands that. I mean, there's a need for trade. There's a need for bringing resources into the country. So, you know, using that leverage, I think that if with persistence and united front, that when all the regional actors are looking for a peaceful resolution, we can have that kind of pressure. I think that we'll ultimately get this peacefully resolved.
Now, I understand you led a bipartisan group of members in a letter to President Obama on this issue and Syria. And has there been any response? Is there? How do you think the message is coming? This is a bipartisan effort.
Yes, it is. And in fact, even beyond just this letter, and absolutely we sent letters, but I'm also the author, along with my colleague, a good friend, Democrat from Vermont, Peter Welch. We're the authors of a bill that would require a congressional authorization before we take any military action. In my view, this is consistent with the Constitution, very clear, the Constitution and the first generation that lived under the Constitution, that, you know, before any military action is taken, that the people's representatives would be on record authorizing that. So whether mm-hmm. it be declaration of war, authorization to use force, this comes from the people's representatives. There is a provision for the commander-in-chief to take action if there is an emergency. Mm-hmm. Emergency as defined by an attack on our country or the imminent threat of an attack. But neither of those circumstances are in play here. They're
right.
not applying.
Right.
So our bill requires that. You can't authorize or expend funds before that authorization happens. So mm-hmm. it's not only bipartisan, it's also bicameral. Peter Welch, myself, Rick Nolan, others. And then on the Senate side, we had Senator Lee, Senator Udall, Senator Rand Paul. So we continue to bring that kind of pressure to bear. I mean, candidly, what we're up against is there are establishment forces, not just the president, but as you probably have seen this weekend, there are members of Congress in both parties who believe the president has the authorization to move now. And that's just not my read of this. And some people invoke the War Powers Act of 1973, but I think it's absolutely a misreading of the War Powers Act. The War Powers Act states right up front that those three stipulations have to be met before anything further in the War Powers Act applies, and that's a declaration or an authorization, both of which come from the people's representatives, or an emergency as defined by an attack on the United States. So, so you know, this is where we are today. A lot of discussion. I can tell you that I feel warm support from my constituents. My view on this has been clear for several months, mm-hmm. Being involved in all these activities. And, in fact, it's similar to work that we've done earlier. I have a bill to reform the War Powers Act to bring more clarity to that situation. And I feel support across the political spectrum, Democrats, Republicans, independents alike, recognizing that it's a very, very difficult issue, and we're very torn by and upset by the humanitarian crisis, but recognizing that that military force won't resolve the matter, and in any case, it has to be authorized constitutionally before we take action.
Well, I think that's an excellent stance, and I have to mention my feelings personally that, you know, I find it interesting that someone with your background would actually be speaking in a fashion and saying, you know, no, we need to show restraint. We need to not jump into military action. And so I think that resonates with your constituents in as much as, you know, maybe we wouldn't expect that from someone of your background. And it just shows that, you know, the length that you're going to research the issue, and that sometimes it's not always the best course of action and there might be other ways. And, you know, the whole issue of, you know, the terrible things that happen during war and innocent victims and, you know, how can we move forward and save lives as opposed to just jumping in you know, with a military response.
Well, I thank you for those very kind comments. I would also tell you that I'm still in pretty good contact with my paratroopers. It's mm-hmm. been 3 years now since I retired from the Army, but I often hear from my paratroopers, and they support these views. They want to make sure that before we go to war, that it is something that is absolutely in the urgent national security interests of our country, that the American people support them, that they would be constitutionally authorized. So, you know, especially for folks who've been there, like, for
right.
example, in Iraq,
sure.
how hard that was. I mean, you know, this is the thing sometimes, candidly, that frustrates me in the Congress, mm-hmm. is I hear from my colleagues and they talk about how hard it is to come together to get things done. And I'm like, you know what? This is challenging, but it's not hard like I've seen. You know, this is a country, us. We have so much more in common than we ever have apart. We can find ways to come together, to move our country, to unite it, and to move it forward. Compared to Iraq, for example, one of my tours, I served in Nineveh province. That's in northern Iraq, where Mosul and Tal Afar is. Mm-hmm. You know, in that province, we had Sunni, Shia, Kurds, Turkmen, Yazidis, Zoroasters, Christians, and Jews, all in one province.
Wow.
And, you know, our responsibility was to help bring them together to forge a better future. And oftentimes that was hard because, you know, we would hear from these factions and sometimes they wanted to talk about the last 2,000 years. We were
right.
just trying to get through the end of the week.
Right.
So, you know, but we got through that. We're actually done now. All our troops are home from Iraq. It's not going to be a Jeffersonian democracy. Certainly That is so. But I do think it'll be relatively friendly and relatively stable. But I also think we need to learn from this. We cannot afford another decade like this where we send our troops overseas involved in the internecine competitions within these countries. I think our best role is one of diplomacy and the one of shaping with an economic leverage.
Very good. Now let's talk a little bit about the bipartisan aspect of how you serve in your role as congressman, and I think it serves you well, but I know sometimes you do come under a little fire for that, but I happen to agree with that response, and especially, again, coming from someone of your background and what you just spoke about, where there were 7, 8, 9, 10 different factions who probably weren't at all willing to talk with each other, let alone sit down and try and work together, move forward, because everyone wants their own territory and I'm the best and our way is the best. So, yeah. You know, there's that philosophy also in politics, but, you know, I know you have an understanding or your philosophy is, you know, you've said this many times, in order to move the country forward and allow everyone the ability to live and prosper, we need to work together. Yeah. So why don't you talk about
that a little bit,
Chris?
And, you know, let me say, as I've said many times, look, I'm a proud Republican, but I'm an American first.
Right.
And, you know, and I think that there's certainly room enough to disagree on issues. We can disagree agreeably. We should be civil, treat everyone with dignity and respect. And I think for leaders, what's really important is temperament and the way that we treat one another. And just to illustrate your point, with regard to Iraq, I mean, there was one day I'm sitting and leading a meeting among the sheikhs, and the interesting thing is they were united on one thing that was contrary to reality, I think. They were railing against me and our country. They were saying that you Americans, you don't understand how to treat women. And I'm thinking, oh, my goodness, I'm getting this right now. And because, look, I mean, Iraq has a long ways to go when it comes to treating women. I think they could do so much better. But, you know, at that point, I was left with a decision. Do I stand up and do I rail back? Or, which would have basically caused the whole meeting to grind to a halt, and we would not have been achieving our objectives. I decided that it would be better to allow them to speak, and then when they wore themselves out, to get them focused back on task, which is to work on the issues that united the Iraqi people so that they could move their country forward. So I think there are times when a leader, you have to be able to have thick skin.
Sure.
To your point about, you know, not always do my constituents agree with me on everything. I think it's important that I listen to what they have to say. But, you know, the goals that I have, I actually derive from listening. There are three. There are three broad goals, and that's to grow this economy so that everyone gets a shot at the American dream, to move back to a balanced budget so that future generations get the same choices and freedoms that we had. And then third is to protect our exceptional way of life, yes, from threats from abroad, but also protect us from unintentional or maybe even intentional encroachment on our civil liberties, on our Bill of Rights here at home. So my record has been very consistent and very clear on all three since the moment I retired from the Army. So I think that you see this from March of 2010 until now in late August of 2013, a consistency in representation that treats everyone with dignity and respect, that pursues those goals, that looks to unite, not divide. And I think when folks take the moment to actually reflect on that and to look at my record, I think that they will see that consistency, and it's important for our country. So, you know, for example, just several things, because oftentimes, you know, the media will focus on today. I think the cliche or the easy story is the hyper-partisanship and the divisions in Congress, and certainly we need to do better on that. There's no question. However, you miss the stories when we actually work together because of that, because evidently they don't,
well,
you know, the media,
sexy.
They're not there. Yeah. And I don't think that sells. But, you know, examples, the trade agreements. We rectified unfair trade practices for our manufacturers and our farmers with regard to South Korea, Panama, and Colombia. We had the situation where we were paying four times higher tariffs than our competitors coming this way. Who would go for that?
Right.
I wouldn't go for that. You wouldn't go for that. And
absolutely
we fixed
not.
That. Democrats and Republicans in the House, Democrats and Republicans in the Senate, working with the president, and we got that done. And, you know, the assessment is it's going to
create 250,000 jobs. It's going to add $10 billion to our GDP. And we're already finding that these trade agreements are making a difference. You note our trade balance. And in fact, if you were to discount, and you wouldn't want to, but just for a moment, for the sake of data, energy and fish, we actually have a trade surplus. And these trading agreements have helped us on that score, and it's helping grow and create opportunities. Same thing with transportation. You know, we got a transportation bill done last Congress. It wasn't perfect, but you know what? It was good for upstate New York. It was good for our country, and it's helping revitalize our infrastructure, and of course, that helps keep people to work as well.
Sure.
We worked on, I think, an important veterans bill that's helping particularly with retraining and getting veterans back to work. We just did, last month, we did a student loan bill that ensured that we didn't double the rate for our students when they take out a student loan. So, you know, these are just several examples where, you know, coming from a pragmatist standpoint, consistent with those three broad goals of growing the economy, moving back to a balanced budget, and to protecting freedoms, that you can bring people together and you can get things done. So, you know, this is what I'm fighting for now. I'm fighting for our rural economy, a farm bill that I think is really important. We're so vested, our district. We listen very carefully. We have an ag advisory council. We also engaged with conservation experts and with Lyme disease advocates fighting that. And we have a couple dozen provisions in this farm bill that came directly from the ideas of people who live here. And we worked with legislative council, and we got them into the farm bill. So I think it's important that we get this farm bill done this year, and I think we're going to see more action on it this coming month in September, just as an illustration.
Very good. Well, at this point, we're going to take a break and listen to some Johnny Cash, Man in Black. And when we come back, we're going to talk more with Chris about the farm bill, his interest in agriculture in the community, and also Lyme disease, broadband, any number of issues. So stay tuned, everybody. We will be back soon.
Well, you wonder why I always dress in black, why you never see bright colors on my back, and why does my appearance seem to have a somber tone? Well, there's a reason for the things that I have on. I wear the black for the poor and the beaten down, living in the hopeless, hungry side of town. I wear it for the prisoner who has long paid for his crime, but is there because he's a victim of the time. I wear the black for those who've never read or listened to the words that Jesus said about the road to happiness through love and charity. Why, you think he's talking straight to you and me? Well, we're doing mighty fine, I do suppose, in our streak of lightning cars and fancy clothes. But just so we're reminded of the ones who are held back, up front there ought to be a man in black. I wear it for the sick and lonely old, for the reckless ones whose bad trip left them cold. I wear the black in mourning for the lives that could have been. Each week we lose 100 fine young men. And I wear it for the thousands who have died, believing that the Lord was on their side. I wear it for another 100,000 who have died, believing that we all were on. Things need changing everywhere you go. But till we start to make a move to make a few things right, you'll never see me wear a suit of white. Oh, I'd love to wear a rainbow every day and tell the world that everything's okay. But I'll try to carry off a little darkness on my back. Till things are brighter, I'm the man in black.
And we're back.
Old MacDonald.
Live on the air.
E-I-E-I-O. And on this farm.
We were going to sing some Old MacDonald. I'm not sure if we're back or not. Are we back, Phil?
Yes, you're back.
We are back. Phil tells me we're back, so we are back. Thank you for listening. I'm Holly Tanner. This is The Right Opinion on WGXC 90.7 on your FM dial. I'm here with Congressman Chris Gibson. And before we jump back in, I want to remind everyone that we are doing a sustaining support drive now through Friday, August 30th. And what that means is, you know, this is a local radio station. I know Chris supports local activities. I certainly support local activities. Buy local, support your local DMV, all your local stores. And WGXC is a local radio station working hard, and they can use some funds. So sustaining membership is very easy to do. You can simply go to WGXC.org. online and sign up to donate. You can donate any amount, $1, can change it any time, but it will really go a long way in helping this radio station. So please consider becoming a sustaining supporter, and we thank you for that. And so now we're back live with Congressman Chris Gibson. So Chris, you wanted to talk about some other things going on?
Yeah, well,
no labels. What does that mean? You buy
well, indeed. I mean, so it sort of follows on to the conversation we had right before the break.
Yes.
And that is, you know, there are many of us that want to do better in the Congress. We want to continue to improve. And so the no labels is just what that it's Republicans and Democrats. It's conservatives and liberals. Check your label, but not your principles. You come together. If there's 20 different issues and you disagree on 12, let's work on the 8 that we agree upon. And so that's what we're doing. I'm a co-chair, a leader in this organization. It's about 80 members of Congress, most of which are in the House side, but we have senators as well, and they're in both parties. And we've had some success. No budget, no pay, for example, came out of our organization, and we passed that in the spring. We unveiled a group of 9 bills on the 18th of July. I'm the author of one of them that has to do with veterans. It's a pretty commonsensical bill. It looks to merge the systems and the records from the DOD and the VA so that, you know, when a young lad or lassie raises their right hand, from the time that they do that until they go to the grave, they would have one medical record that would stay with them. And, you know, we have found from listening to veterans that among their frustrations is that when they make the transition from active duty to back to the community, the record, you know, we don't have that full accounting of that record in the VA. In this day and age, that's just unacceptable. And so this is a bipartisan, bicameral bill, and we like its chances going forward. And that's one example. We also, in No Labels, we're working good government initiatives, budget reforms that Democrats, Republicans can agree upon, that smarter use of taxpayer dollars. And so, you know, we're going to continue to advance these bills going forward. And I think it, you know, what I found in my experiences in life, including in Iraq, is that when you get in the habit of pragmatism, when you get in the habit of getting things done, then all of a sudden what look like a situation where you couldn't find common agreement looks differently. So, you know, Aristotle once said, you make a good person one day at a time by habit. And this is what we're trying to do, is put our service first. And so look for more from, in fact, you can learn more about No Labels by going to nolabels.org. And you can learn about our organization. So looking to make a stronger America.
Well, that's great. We'll all look into nolabels.org. Let's talk about for a second, you know, why did you come back into public service, Chris?
Yeah.
I mean, you did have
a
chance.
Well, it was a calling. You know, it was a calling for me, you know, seeing in 2009 our country coming apart, moving in the wrong direction. And I thought I had something to give here. In fact, a lot of our young men and women have a lot to give that were in the military and who have seen service in Iraq, because so much of what we asked them to do was to bring people together, the negotiating skills, professionalism, on task, mission first. And, you know, so I came out and of the military and ran for office, and 7 months later was elected. And so I've been focused on this since the moment I raised my right hand to continue serving, is to grow that economy so everyone gets a shot. And that's really important, too, by the way. My voting record reflects that. That, you know, it's not just the shareholders, it's also the workers, I'm proud. I was, when I was in the military, I was pro paratrooper. I was pro soldier, and I'm proud to be pro worker. And I say that because that's part of the American dream.
Absolutely.
That everybody, it's not just for the, you know, for the shareholders to do well. It's we want to grow this economy. I support business expansion and business growth because for all the right reasons, which is that there's more opportunity with that growth and everyone does better. So growing the economy, getting back to that balanced budget, because when we're in deficit, we're actually spending our children's money.
Right.
It's not funny money. I mean, that's going to have to be paid at some point. So we need to get ourselves back to a balanced budget thoughtfully. And then, of course, to protect the freedoms.
Right. Absolutely. Now, one of the issues I know near and dear to your heart is farming in your district, the farmers. And you've often said we have the best farmers in this area. And I like that. I grew up on a dairy farm, and my dad still is a doesn't farm anymore, but he's still a great farmer. And so, you know, you mentioned the farm bill. So why don't you update us on that?
Well, I say right up front, I am biased. I mean, I think we have the smartest, the hardest working farmers in the world. But, you know, there are things we need to do to support them. This is a very difficult time for a farmer, actually. So, but with that in mind, we put a fine point focus on trying to bring forward policy reforms that help the rural economy, and especially farmers. So here's what we've done. And we listened to our dairy farmers, and, you know, the issue for dairy, there are a number of them, but centrally there are problems in the way that they're reimbursed. We didn't get to every place where we wanted to go on that, but we did get, I think, an important provision that's going to ensure their viability. And that is this. Last summer, when we had the drought, the grain prices spiked up. And the hundredweight price that they were getting for their milk wasn't keeping up. Mm-hmm. So we had dairy farmers that were working 7 days a week to lose money.
Yeah.
And what we've done, this important policy provision essentially links together these grain prices, these inputs for the grains, with the hundredweight price. So that if we have a situation like last year where we have a spike in the grain prices, that this marginal insurance framework will ensure that the price that they get for their milk moves along with it, a $4 at no cost to the farmer, they will have that linkage. They'll have that margin of $4 beyond what their grain prices. That's an important provision. We need to do it because, look, I often say, and sometimes folks I think will push back a little bit on me, but I want to explain that I say this is a national security issue. Here's why. You know, as somebody who spent 29 years in uniform, multiple tours overseas, you know, we were heavily involved because of our energy requirements. You know, I want to see us get out of that business and be energy independent. I don't ever want to see us get in the business of guarding food. We end up guarding food, you know, I mean, because, you know, look, humans got to eat. And, you know, and if we're going to continue to be independent on that score, we got to support our farmers.
Absolutely.
It's really that simple. And so, you know, it comes from starting from being empathetic with the plight of our farmers. Because you know what? They're hardworking folks. These are folks that really, I think they represent all that's good in our country. So I talked about dairy. We're also helping fruits and vegetables. And in fact, let me say on a positive note that this census was the first time in 50 years we actually reversed the trends. We're growing in farms. And you're looking right here. This is the epicenter.
Wow.
The Hudson River Valley, Columbia County, for example. Columbia County, whereas the average age of a farmer in New York across the state is 57.
Okay.
45% of the farmers in Columbia County are beginning farmers.
Wow.
Most of which are young, but not all. Mm-hmm. There have some folks who've had, you know, in their 60s have had an epiphany and want to pick up farming, and that's an awesome thing. But most of them are young.
Yeah.
So we're actually reversing.
It's amazing.
Yeah, and we're reversing the trend here. So what we're doing to help is a number of things to facilitate this. One is one of the issues we have for fruits and vegetable growers is the crop insurance program that we have right now. It doesn't work for us in the Northeast. It was essentially written for the corporate farms in the Midwest and the West. If you grow one crop and you have thousands of acres of that one crop, this crop insurance program works for you. But if you have a parcel of land where you may rotate crops, you may actually grow two or three different items of produce on that same land.
Right.
The crop insurance program doesn't work for us. So what we've done is we've got provisions in there to reform that, to write a program that our farmers will actually want to buy. We learned this writ large when we went through Irene and Lee, because many of our farmers were not covered because of this this issue with the crop insurance program. We also increased investments for research. There is a direct correlation between the research done for specialty crops and the yield. And not for nothing, but the Cornell Cooperative Extension often wins these competitions. So we get the second order effect of an advancement in our local economies, and at the same time we're helping our fruit and vegetable growers.
That's great.
We've also, along with my colleague, also a veteran, Tim Walls, a retired sergeant major, he represents a Democrat from Minnesota. We were the co-authors of the Farmer Rancher Opportunity Act. And what this bill did is it was aimed at inspiring a new generation to come to the farm. I mentioned what the average age of a farmer is. Well, we recognize that we have to inspire a whole new generation to come to the farm. So by listening, and by the way, some of our leaders in the Young Farmers Coalition come from right here. Lindsay Shute, right down the road here in Claremont and Tivoli area, Hardy Roots Farm. She is actually a leader in the Young Farmers Coalition. So we listened to her. We had a series of staff meetings with her to hear from her organization, and that's what formed the bill, the Farmer Rancher Opportunity Bill. This is an example. I really do want to mention this to our constituents, to our listeners out there, that this is an example of representative government working, where you have the people expressing ideas and it getting rolled into a bill. And so, you know, listening to the young farmers, actually, their number one issue, which, I mean, I have to tell you, I learned this. I'm not sure I would have said this. Their number one issue is access to land. Access to land. They have a number of challenges. I didn't realize that that would be the first, the number one challenge, but it is. So what we've done in the farm bill is we have provisions in there that help with access to land, in particular a transition program for potential or soon-to-be retiring farmers. They bring on mentorees. There are tax credits that are involved here in the conservation programs that allow us to make it easier for access to land for aspiring young farmers. Also, access to training. And in fact, we have some of the best training going on right here in the Hudson River Valley. Martin Ping over at Hawthorne Valley, he leads one of these. And we have some great programs in both Columbia and Greene County that help train aspiring young farmers. Also, access to credit. Not only traditional credit lines, but we developed, along Lindsay's idea, but we have a microloan program that goes explicitly for young farmers that's in the farm bill here, coming from her idea. And also access to discounts on insurance for the first 5 years. Because, and by the way, there's provisions in there for conservation that help young farmers too, and grant opportunities. But the point is this, that we recognize that that first decade is a very challenging time for our beginning farmers, and we literally and figuratively want them to get their roots in the ground. And that's what – so we got two-thirds of that that bill, Farmer Rancher Opportunity Act, into the Farm Bill. So you can see that – I mean, there are a variety of reasons. That, along with broadband, we help expand broadband in this bill. We help fight Lyme disease in this bill.
Yeah, let's talk about Lyme disease a little bit.
Yeah.
Columbia County is –
well, it's a good transition here because let me just wrap up the Farm Bill and then move to Lyme. So it's very important that we get this Farm Bill done. There has been some controversy with regard to the food stamp program. I can just tell you, we're going to work this out. You know, the parties, we're going to work together to get an agreement on this issue so that it doesn't stop the Farm Bill. And we need to get that done this year because, you know, like I said, this is important for rural America. And so part of this, I mentioned Lyme. So, you know, let's spend a few minutes here on Lyme. The first thing is the challenges. You know, this is a major public health issue.
Huge.
Huge for our area. You can't go really a day or two without running into somebody who's been either personally afflicted or they have a close family or friend that's been impacted. And, you know, our challenge is, first of all, we don't have a test that even picks up half the cases of Lyme. In a country as great as ours, this is unacceptable. We have ELISA out there right now, and then the Western Blot would follow that up. But the issues that I see is that essentially we draw your blood and we look for the evidence that the body is fighting the Lyme, and that's how we call that a test positive. But, you know, given the nature of the spirochete as part of this, of the tick-borne diseases, this is pernicious, and it can actually hide, quite candidly, and we will not pick up these Lyme cases. So we have been part of this effort. We've led to get more resources for better research, for better testing.
Sure.
And including about $9 million for that. There have been advances on this score. I'm somewhat optimistic, actually, that we will get a test that goes beyond the antibodies into DNA testing. So why this is so important is this, is that unfortunately the medical community is divided on this issue. I mean, there are doctors who believe there is no such thing as chronic Lyme.
Still.
Yes. And so among the reasons why testing is important is because one thing that everyone agrees upon is the earlier you detect a tick-borne disease,
right,
the better chances for a full recovery.
That's
that
right.
Your body will respond to the 3 weeks of doxycycline,
right,
of some kind of antibiotic, that you will end up making in that full recovery.
Right.
But if in the event that you don't get this detected early,
right,
there is a chance that this will go into neurological system, and you're looking at chronic, long-term adverse
health
impacts,
issues, sure,
health issues coming from Lyme. And so what we're doing is we're advocating for better testing, better treatment. Look, I mean, among the challenges is that we have some doctors now who are trying to help constituents with chronic Lyme conditions,
mm-hmm,
and they're at risk of legal action because their actions are outside the guidelines.
Wow.
So here they are trying to help constituents. Well, see, this is why. I'll tell you, this is why one of our major priorities to help on the situation with Lyme is to get the guidelines, the Centers for Disease Control, the CDC guidelines,
uh-huh,
updated and changed. According to the government's own rules, these guidelines are supposed to be updated every 5 years. These guidelines that are currently in existence haven't been updated in 7 years. So I have written to the government on this, and I've said, look, we've got to update these guidelines. There's all kinds of research that points to the fact that we've got chronic Lyme that we're dealing with here, and we need to update. We need better testing, better treatment. Why this is important is, along with the better testing, this, by changing the guidelines, we will get better treatment. And some of the experimental treatment that's going on is not being reported. Successes, because the doctors are loath to send in the data of the successful experimental treatment because it exposes them to litigation,
wow,
and to potential punitive actions. So, but here's the other piece of this. Why the guidelines need to change is because the insurance coverage is woefully inadequate.
Yes.
And when you approach the insurance companies, they say, well, look, it's not approved care. So, and this is just, it's unacceptable.
That's very unacceptable.
We need to focus on changing these guidelines because I think it will lead to better diagnosis, better treatment, and better coverage. Right now, a constituent, for a one-time consultation, $1,000. Now, who's got that kind of money?
Wow.
This is why it's a major health...
Outrageous.
Yeah. And look, there are things that we can do. I'm going to get to the farm bill in a second. But number one is awareness of this.
Mm.
And when you go out, we want to strike the balance. We don't want folks to stop going outside. I mean, because it's important for a balanced life, for a full, flourishing form of life. You know, for our family, we went down to Catamount.
Mm-hmm.
On Sunday for that challenge. It's
mm-hmm.
really, it was a great time, you know, to be out and to be climbing and to be negotiating obstacles and the zip line.
A lot of fun, yeah.
And it was important to, you know, it's important to youth, I think, to their growth, to their confidence building.
Sure.
We want folks to be outside, hiking and other things like that. But at the same time, we want them to take protections to make
yeah.
sure that, so you're talking about tick awareness.
Right.
And when you get home, if you've been in a high-risk area, maybe yep. tumble dry your clothes, look in the particularly the hotspot areas for
yep.
ticks,
yep.
and they like to go where blood is restricted.
Yeah.
So there's certain things we can do on the front end without having to change necessarily our life
right.
in terms, but
right.
just be more aware. And now the other piece of this is the environmental side of this, that is to say things that we can do that can help get after ticks themselves. This is the new front. I wouldn't say new front, but the more expanded front we're opening against the tick-borne diseases now, and that is in the Farm Bill, is in the Ag Research Service, that we would have resources.
Okay.
We'd have the ability to apply for requests for proposals where we can get research done, and we have some of the best researchers actually right here in our district. Dr. Osfeld,
mm-hmm.
who's down at the Cary Institute in Dutchess County, he's done some of the, I think, the most advanced work on this that allows us to understand the prevalence of ticks and how we can address that in our own actions. So, you know, this is, I think, an important investment. You know, a number of years ago, we had a vaccine, about 8 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
The problem was we had some complications from the vaccine, so it was pulled from the market. So you can actually get a vaccine for your dog and for your
right,
pet.
Right, right, right.
But you can't get one for a person.
Right.
But what we
which
need
is
to,
odd.
and what we need to do right now is just to open up that front, which recognizes the tick and the prevalence of the tick
right.
and how is it we can address that to depress the tick population so that we can better protect ourselves from Lyme. So, and actually not just Lyme, but tick-borne diseases.
There's many.
And this is the other piece of it I think is encouraging. I want to say this, that
mm-hmm.
there has been some research in our area, international internationally recognized, at least by some, from our area, that shows the correlation of tick-borne diseases. So with one tick bite, you could get co-infections. And why I think this is important is not only for us understanding this issue, which will help us address it, but also it's helping, in my view, I hope it brings the medical community back together. Because, you know, you've had some doctors who will deny this existence of chronic Lyme, but if it can be shown that it's Babesia or any right. number of – or Powassan, which is – this is this latest tick-borne disease
right,
that actually
can be
killed
deadly.
A young boy yeah. from Poughkeepsie. But when we show these co-infections, I think that allows the space for the whole medical community to come back in together so we can all fight this together. So, look, a lot more to be done here. Our efforts are focused on better research so that we can get better testing and better treatment and to change the guidelines. And so any help, if folks are interested in helping on this,
yes.
that would reach out to maybe their family and friends in other districts to contact their representative or senator ask them to support these efforts. I think it's really important we stay focused on this.
Absolutely. It's a huge issue in Columbia County. My father had babesiosis, and still it was a two-year ordeal that we kind of went through, and it does kind of tie in with the farming in Columbia County and a lot of your district being a very rural area. And we love the outdoors,
yeah.
especially this time of year. And so it's amazing something so little could wreak such havoc. We have a few more minutes, and I want you to address really quickly the NSA.
Yeah.
And you have like 2 minutes to do this, so we're not going to be able to get to some questions. There were some, and I want to remind people to stay tuned. Coming up at 11 o'clock, Tyson with Zoom Knots and Bolts. We have 7 minutes, so you really have.
Well,
go
here
ahead.
Here's the
NSA.
I mentioned at the outset that the three goals that we're advancing and that I think unites our district is to grow this economy, to move back to a balanced budget, and to protect freedoms from threats from abroad, but also from encroachment on our Bill of Rights, on our freedoms at home. My record is very clear in support of the Bill of Rights, all of right. the Bill of Rights. So as it relates to the NSA, this latest dust-up, I would tell you that some folks, including in our district and myself, we've been on this for some time. You know, 6 weeks after getting to the Congress, the Patriot Act was up for reauthorization. And, you know, it was presented to me. Leadership said, look, everybody's going to vote for this. We're just going to reauthorize it for 3 years, and we're going to move on. And I said, hold on. You know, I'm going to read this. And when I went through the Patriot Act, there were provisions in the Patriot Act. Well, there was one provision facially unconstitutional. It had to do with roving wiretaps and the fact that a general description for a warrant would do. Now, if you believe that, you've got to change the Constitution because the last clause of the Fourth Amendment is very clear. You need specificity in terms of person, place, and thing. General description doesn't work.
Yeah.
So that aspect of the Patriot Act was facially unconstitutional. There was another section of the Constitution or of the Patriot Act that was argumentatively unconstitutional. I was very concerned. It was Section 215 called the Business Records Section. And here, there's language in there that said that the government can get access to telecommunications if there's relevancy to an investigation. And so I said, what do you mean by relevant?
Right.
Because there is a process for a warrant. I mean, if there's probable cause, we have a constitutional process that allows for a warrant to be issued from another branch of government, not the executive branch, but from the judicial branch, that allows for a proceeding to take place. But the problem was there wasn't specificity in the section. So as a consequence of all this, I voted no on the Patriot Act reauthorization. Now, that was in February of 2011 because I was concerned that we'd be stepping on our Bill of Rights. Well, here we are now in 2013, and you know, we see these stories and
right.
these revelations that the government has been collecting all the metadata on our phone calls and looking into telecommunications broadly. And here's the point. The government has – the administration has defined relevant as everything.
Yeah.
I mean, look, this is wrong.
It's scary.
This is wrong. So I voted for the Amash Amendment that would have rolled back Section 215 that said you need to have probable cause. There's got to be a warrant. We have a right. The Fourth Amendment. This is for all of us. This is for all of us. And it says you have the right to be reasonably secure in your person, your place, and things.
Right.
And that there are procedures for – warrants to be written. And, you know, so what we've said in this amendment is we said we roll back Section 215 and say the government has to have probable cause or they can't collect this information on us. The government's argument is they collect all this metadata mm-hmm. and they call it a haystack, and then if they have need to look for a needle, they got the haystack to come look for it.
Wow.
But that's unacceptable. This is not how we function here in America. There has to be probable cause before there can be a collection on you, on us. And so I not only voted for that, and it was a close vote. It was 207 to 215 or something uh-huh. like that. And but I'm also the co-sponsor of a bill, Libert-E, that mm-hmm. would also do the same thing in an independent vote. So
okay. This
is consistent with my representation. I have stood up for the Bill of Rights and voted against CISPA. I stand up for the Second Amendment. I stand up for the Sixth Amendment. I view the Bill of Rights is really what made us exceptional and different from any other country. Well, I mean, there was the Magna Carta, but mm-hmm. here's the point. We put together the Constitution, which had the separation of powers in it, along with federalism as a check to the federal government. We allowed the states to also have a check on that separation of powers. And also beyond undergirding all that is a Bill of Rights as our check.
Right.
And I stand up strong for all of these amendments in the Bill of Rights because I believe in the notion that we can live free and we can be self-governing. So, and I don't think that's a partisan issue.
Right.
I was at a Second Amendment rally down in Sullivan County a few days ago. And standing with me was Aileen Gunther, mm-hmm. A Democratic Assemblywoman,
sure.
And who we're on the same page when it comes to the Bill of Rights. And she voted against the so-called SAFE Act. So, mm-hmm. you know, I think that this should be an issue that unites us, not divides us.
Right. Well, we are going to close on that note. We could spend another hour here talking with our good congressman. And, you know, I want to say again that, you know, folks listening in today, Chris didn't have prepared comments. He really didn't have – he has a little leather-covered notebook with some notes jotted in it, but it just shows the depth of knowledge that you have and the issues that face us. And it's not only Syria and national and world global issues, but it's down to a little tiny tick that you have to worry about and everything else in between. And it's just – you know, it's amazing. I have to worry about, you know – DMV and all the things that go on in there. And so, you know, just the scope of things that you have to be responsible for and how you've dove in is really quite remarkable, Chris. And so give you a commendation for that because it really is quite amazing the scope of knowledge you have.
Thank you very much for the thoughtful and supportive comments.
And
also I appreciate
the
opportunity.
Folks.
Thank you, Ollie. And thank you, Phil, for this opportunity. Let me just say that in addition to our legislative work, we work very diligently for cases, for constituents. So,
yeah,
you know,
tell people how they can get in touch locally.
So we have an office in Kinderhook that for Columbia and Green. And for those who may be in Catskill, we have an office in Kingston as well, if that's a shorter drive for you. But we're here to serve you. If you're a veteran having issues with the VA, a senior citizen having issues with a Medicare or Social Security issue, we're here to serve you. If you got a passport, immigration issue, you can reach out to us and we will work your cases. And, you know, we work, I think, about 90 or so cases a week in our offices. So we're here to serve you. It's an honor and privilege. I think the listeners probably know, but I'm not looking to be a career politician. I have self-imposed term limits. I've said the most I'll serve is 8 years. This is, I think, the way the founders initially intended
Absolutely.
It. For we are a self-governing nation. You know, that we have citizens who step forward for a period of time, and then they go back to the community from where they came. It's an honor and privilege to serve you. Thank you for this opportunity, and God bless all the listeners.
Thank you
there.
So much, Congressman. Again, that was fabulous and very enlightening. Stay tuned, folks, for Tyson Zoom Knots and Bolts coming up at 11, and I'll be back on September 11th when we're going to have a special show in remembrance of that very horrific day in American history. So tune in on September 11th, and we will see you soon, WGXC.